Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting the Trump administration not reacting to a spokesman's denial that former President Barack Obama ordered a telephone tap on Mr. Trump during the campaign before last year's U.S. elections. President Trump made the accusations on Twitter without naming any source for his claims. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
I'm very worried that our president is suggesting that the former president has done something illegally. I would be very worried if, in fact, the Obama administration was able to obtain a warrant lawfully about Trump campaign activity with foreign governments.
President Trump's claim against Mr. Obama came as the Trump administration faces mounting pressure from multiple investigations into contacts between members of his campaign team and Russian officials during the 2016 presidential race. Supporters of President Trump held rallies across the country Saturday. So-called Spirit of America demonstrations were organized by a group called the Main Street Patriots, which is made up by some of the same people that founded the Tea Party movement 8 years ago to voice concerns about the way federal government operates. Eaton Eller was out on the streets in front of President Trump's New York City residence.
I'm here to support Trump and support the USA, a free, democratic USA, to make America great again.
Mr. Trump, driving through the state of Florida toward his vacation home, stopped his motorcade briefly to see a group of about 100 cheering supporters on the roadside. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and actor Danny Glover joined thousands of protesters in the state of Mississippi to call for workers' rights to join a union. Sanders and Glover spoke to the marchers, and the so-called March on Mississippi was organized in support of unionization at a Nissan assembly plant in Canton. United Auto Workers has long struggled to unionize foreign-owned auto plants. This is VOA News. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces have begun a new push toward the center of the city of Mosul in an attempt to take positions still held by Islamic State militants. Iraqi military officials said Sunday they have overtaken several villages in West Mosul in the latest fighting as they move toward the old section of the city. The offensive has been delayed in recent days by bad weather. Thousands of civilians flee the fighting each day. Since the government's initial push into the western side of the city began February 19th, U.S. and Iraqi commanders have described fierce IS resistance as the extremist force seeks to hold its last significant urban area in the war-ravaged country. Islamic State has taken credit for executing a kidnapped officer of Pakistan's Prime Intelligence Agency a day after police found his body in the central city of Multan. Local police said the body was dressed in an orange uniform. Like detainees at the U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba, the officer was serving in a counterterrorism unit of Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, the country's main spy agency. Forces loyal to Libya's top eastern military commander say they have hounded Islamist militia fighters who captured key oil ports. And Iranian reports from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
They think that people here...
A militia spokesman, Yasser Jabali, claimed his men were holding their ground. Mamdouh Salami, a London-based oil analyst, told Libyan TV that control of the country's two largest oil ports, Ras Lanuf and Sidra, are always a main interest of the country's militias and of the National Unity Government because they are the key to the country's economy and ultimate control of Libya. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
South Korean lawmakers are preparing to consider legislation awarding nearly $900,000 to North Korean defectors with classified information about the reclusive Pyongyang government. South Korea's news agency reported on the legislation today, saying that the amount is fourfold increase over what is currently paid to defectors with sensitive information. The report said the legislation is aimed at persuading more North Korean elites to switch sides. Thousands of delegates from around China have gathered in Beijing for the annual parliament session that began Sunday in the Great Hall of the People. Mayor Liu Cheng told the delegates China wants to expand its economic growth by about 6.5% of GDP in 2017. Last year, China's targeted growth was between 6.5 to 7% and came in at 6.7%, the lowest pace in 26 years. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have come to understand more deeply the root causes of all of these crises. You cannot tackle terrorism without also tackling poverty. You cannot tackle terrorism without also thinking about education.
The UN Security Council expresses support for countries in West Africa battling Boko Haram.
What has happened is the motion was tabled on a vote of no confidence. It was put before Parliament, it was debated in Parliament, and then it was passed.
The Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho, Pakadita Mosisidi, suffers a vote of no confidence in his government.
We don't think that we have really seen the Council of State performing the kind of function that, you know, it was made into our constitution.
And Ghanaians question the functions and performance of the Council of State. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The UN Security Council visited Chad and Niger Saturday, expressing support for countries in West Africa that are battling Boko Haram and coping with the humanitarian fallout from the war on terror. VOA's Margaret Bashir is traveling with the delegation and has this report from the Nigerian capital, Niamey.
Chad and Niger are both fighting Boko Haram terrorists who threaten their territory and launch attacks on their populations and their militaries. Just 2 weeks ago, Niger lost 16 soldiers in an attack by the group in the north of the country.
Mais le terrorisme ne peut pas être vaincu uniquement par l'engagement militaire.
Chad's Prime Minister Albert Tahimi Padeki tells VOA that terrorism cannot only be defeated militarily, development is necessary so that the people will not just listen to the extremists. This strategy is echoed by Niger's president, Mahamadou Issoufou, who says his country needs better infrastructure, education, health care, and jobs for its youth. He told the visiting Security Council ambassadors that social and economic development promote democracy. Chad and Niger are both at the very bottom of the UN Development Index. In addition to struggling with extreme poverty, they are coping with severe humanitarian crises, trying to feed and shelter hundreds of thousands of displaced persons and refugees who have fled Boko Haram's reign of terror, as well as violence in Libya, Mali, and the Central African Republic. British Ambassador Matthew Rycroft, who was co-leading the Security Council's visit, acknowledged the need for a holistic approach in dealing with the effects of the crisis.
We have come to understand more deeply the root causes of all of these crises. You cannot tackle terrorism without also tackling poverty. You cannot tackle terrorism without also thinking about education, employment, social development, agriculture, human rights, the role of women and children in society, refugees, and so much more.
A multinational joint task force made up of countries from the Lake Chad Basin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and Benin, have about 10,000 troops on the ground working to end the threat of Boko Haram. The council visited the task force headquarters in N'Djamena on Saturday, where they were told the terrorist group has been substantially degraded and pushed out of many of their strongholds to the hundreds of islands that dot Lake Chad. The task force says it has killed about 828 Boko Haram fighters since January 2016 and arrested more than 600 others. The force has also destroyed 32 Boko Haram camps. But as these two countries continue to spend heavily on containing security threats, development continues to suffer. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, Niamey.
The embattled Prime Minister of Lesotho, Pakadita Mosisidi, plans to meet the King Monday to decide the next political steps forward. This after Parliament passed a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister. It followed a decision by some parliamentarians from his ruling coalition to join the opposition and forming a new political party. Analysts say it's likely the Prime Minister would advise the King to call for fresh election, which could bring to an abrupt end the Moseseidi government. For more about the political situation in Lesotho, I read Mutumi Ralejo, spokesman for Prime Minister Pakadita Moseseidi.
What has happened is the motion was tabled of a vote of no confidence. It was put before Parliament, it was debated in Parliament, and then it was passed, which means that the opposition had the majority and it passed a motion of no confidence on the government and the Prime Minister. Having said that, in accordance with the Lesotho's constitution, the Prime Minister has three options in accordance with part four of that constitution. And four, it says, in the exercise of his powers to dissolve or prorogue Parliament, the King shall act in accordance with the advice of the Prime Minister, provided A, if the Prime Minister recommends a dissolution.
Critics say that the Prime Minister has himself to blame because of his erratic administration of the country. Some parliamentarians in his coalition decided to join the opposition to get rid of him. Do you share in those sentiments?
Well, that could be true because the main party in the coalition, the Democratic Congress, was split in half between the leader, who is the Prime Minister, and his deputy leader, who has now formed his own party.
It appears it will be unlikely for Prime Minister Pakadita Moseseidi to win re-election if the King accepts for snap elections to be called. So basically, you could have former Prime Minister Tom Tabani coming back, because it appears some opposition members are talking to him while he's in exile to come back.
Well, Tom has already spoken to the leader of the newly formed Alliance of Democrats, and though Tom commands the majority in the opposition, Tom has actually agreed with the leader of the Alliance of Democrats, Munyane Muleleki, to lead the opposition coalition. In the motion of no confidence, Munyane Muleleki has been named as the next Prime Minister by the motion of no confidence to the Prime Minister.
So what will be next for Prime Minister Pakadita Moseseidi?
He is highly probable to advise the King to take the second or 4B of the Constitution by advising for a snap election within 90 days. We know that he's going to campaign and then ask the nation to provide him with a new mandate.
Well, do you think the people of Lesotho will repose confidence in him following recent fallout, the sacking of some of his ministers for all sorts of reasons that has led him to this point? Some of his members leaving to form their own party and leaving him exposed for election defeat, perhaps?
The allegiance of parties in the country, it's so deep-rooted that one wonders how this is going to play out. As you know, that the Congress party in the country has been in power since 1993. Though its majority has been shrinking since 1993 until 2012, when Tom formed a coalition party with two other parties, number three became a government. And then we went for 2015 elections. The partisan politics in our country are so deep-rooted that they are split between the Congress believers and the nationalist believers. Though Tom started a convention party, and Muleleki has now started the Alliance of Democrats, but mostly in the majority of people in our country, when they go vote, it is split between the Congress believers and the nationalist believers. It's just like what we saw in the U.S. Last elections, where the majority of people were split between the Republicans and the Democrats.
So how are the people of Lesotho reacting to this news of this political cantata, if I may put it that way?
It is an intense debate between those sides, the nationalists and the Congress believers.
Mutumi Ralejo is the spokesman for Lesotho's Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Ghanaian Center for Democratic Development, or CDD, is calling on the new members of the Council of State to work to the benefit of Ghanaians. Last week, President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo swore in new members of the Council of State at a ceremony in the capital, Accra. But many Ghanaians have questioned the performance of past Council of State and have even called for the institution to be abolished. The Council of State is an advisory, a consultative body for a Ghanaian president. For more on the expectations of Ghanaians on the new Council of State, I read Dr. Franklin Oduro, Deputy Director and Head of Research and Programs at the Center for Democratic Development, or CDD.
We expect this Council of State to be different from what we've seen in this Fourth Republic. The basis or the rationale for which the Council of State came to be in our constitution. We don't think that we have really seen the Council of State performing the kind of functions that it was made into our constitution. And therefore, fundamentally, we want to see a Council of State that will take its constitutional responsibility seriously. Secondly, we also want to see even attempts by this new Council of State to initiate some kind of reforms within the institution itself. Reforms that will make the Council of State impactful.
Talking about the relevance of the Council of State, some Ghanaians I have spoken with say that since it plays only an advisory role and the advice to the president could be accepted or rejected, they should not be paid. What do you say to that? Some of them have even called for constitutional amendment to scrap the benefits that they get. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. In fact, that is why we think that it has to justify its existence. Because it's a body that we spend close to $3.9 million on them, including monthly salaries, security, vehicles, and at the end of 4 years, benefit from Ex Gratia. And if we don't see that kind of impact from the Council of State, then the question remains, is it useful? But we think that until we amend the Constitution to disband it or to, do away with it, so long as it exists, so long as we continue to use taxpayers' money to support this institution, we have every right to demand from the Council of State to do what it ought to do. Indeed, you could argue that the advice of the Council of State is not bound on the president. But we also do know that the Constitution, if you look at Article 91(3), for instance, gives the Council of State a mandate to initiate a public discussion on subject of national interest.
Some people are suggesting that it should be disbanded. Some people are saying that it has, from time past, shrouded its activities in secrecy. There's no transparency. It's only a job for the boys, and they are changed every 4 years, depending on which political party comes to power, and that it perhaps might have served its usefulness. Do you subscribe to such a dismal view of some of these criticisms leveled against the Council of State?
No, I think that there is some legitimacy in some of these criticisms. I think, the way and manner some of the past previous Council of State have treated have given room for some of these criticisms to occur. Indeed, some have even argued that it has become another institution to put party full soldiers, and indeed senior party full soldiers. Because if you have a Council of State and you have members of Council of State who can go on a platform to campaign for a candidate, then the integrity and the respect that such a body should have will not be there. And then people can... So I think that there is some legitimacy in some of the criticisms. And that is why in our statement we are calling for a departure of the past. So long as the Council of State remains And so long as we continue to use state resources, taxpayers' resources to support them, then we have every right to demand of the Council of State to do a better job this time around. So for instance, I mean, I particularly don't understand why if you provide an advice to the president and the president doesn't take it, I think you should be able to ask from the president why I not take it. Give a reason why a certain advice will be taken and one advice will not be taken. The whole idea that the counsel, the advice that you provide is shrouded in secrecy is something that some of us are not too comfortable with. It may be the case that there are certain sensitive matters that should not be in the public domain. But if it's about an advice on appointing someone for a constitutional body, why should that such an advice be made a secret?
Dr. Franklin Odro is the Deputy Director and Head of Research and Programs at the Center for Democratic Development, or CDD. He spoke with me from Accra. Forces loyal to Libyan top Eastern military commander General Khalifa Haftar say they have pounded Islamist militia fighters who captured the key oil port of Sidra and Ras Lanuf. Haftar's forces had controlled the country's oil triangle district since September 2016. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Libyan media reports that Air Force fighter jets loyal to Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar attacked Islamist militia forces holding part of the oil port of Sidra and an airfield in the nearby oil port of Ras Lanuf. Haftar's spokesman, Colonel Ahmed al-Mismari, described the fighting to journalists.
الضربات الجوية متواصلة الوضع ممتاز جدا بدأت طلائع القوات المسلحة الآن تقود الهجوم المضاد.
He says that airstrikes are continuing and that his forces have begun a counterattack against the Islamist militia holding the area and recaptured part of the Ras Lanuf airfield while reinforcing the area around Ras Lanuf with fighters from the east of the country. He says the goal is to crush the militia so that it won't return to the area. Militia forces, calling themselves the Benghazi Defense Brigades, began the surprise attack on Sidra and Ras Lanuf on Thursday. A militia spokesman, Yasser Jabali, claimed his men were holding their ground. He says there was heavy fighting in the area and that 50 or 60 armored personnel carriers loyal to General Haftar tried to encircle his forces but failed. The militia attack coincided with a visit to Moscow by Libya's internationally backed National Unity Government Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj. Sarraj, whose government still has not been approved by the country's parliament in Tobruk, said his forces were not responsible for the attack. Sarraj also insisted that both General Haftar and Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala were blocking mediation efforts by Egypt to hold a face-to-face meeting between himself and the general. Qatar-based Libya Al-Ahrar TV, which backs Islamist militias in Tripoli and Misrata, claimed that the Benghazi Defense Brigades were made up of fighters from Benghazi, which is now under Haftar's control. It claimed that Haftar was using mercenaries from Chad, a charge which his spokesman denied. The so-called Benghazi Defense Brigades were reported to have captured the Libyan desert oil oasis of Jafra in December. It was not clear who was supporting the group, but former UN Special Envoy for Libya, Tariq Mitri, said in an interview last year that certain Gulf countries were backing them covertly. Mamdouh Salami, a London-based oil analyst, told Libyan TV that control of the country's two largest oil ports, Ras Lanuf and Sidra, are always a main interest of the country's militias and of the National Unity Government because they are the key to the country's economy and ultimate control of Libya. Martin Kobler, the outgoing UN Special Envoy for Libya, in a tweet late Friday, urged all parties to refrain from further escalation and to ensure the protection of civilians and of Libya's natural resources and oil facilities. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Unless new antibiotics are developed quickly, people will once again die from common infections. The World Health Organization has issued an urgent call for scientists to develop these new drugs and for governments to fund the research. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
The world is entering a time when common infections could be deadly, and doctors are alarmed. Dr. Trish Pearl is chief of infectious diseases at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She says if there are no effective antibiotics, it will affect the entire practice of medicine.
You all of a sudden understand what it was like to practice medicine maybe 50, 70, 80 years ago when there weren't antibiotics.
More people would die following operations and from infections such as pneumonia. Those most at risk, people in nursing homes, hospitals, and children. Children may have weaker immune systems than adults, and they receive smaller doses of antibiotics than adults do. Dr. Michael Bell is an expert in drug-resistant pathogens at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, known as CDC.
For the longest time, we've had a number of different antibiotics in the pipeline at any given time. And so whenever we ran out of the ability to use one, we would move to the next one.
But that's no longer possible. Laurie Hicks is also with the CDC, where she leads research on antibiotic use and resistance.
We are seeing greater than 2 million episodes of antibiotic-resistant infections in people each year in the U.S. alone. And 23,000 of these episodes result in death.
Joe Larson at the Department of Health and Human Services says the U.S. began to work to develop new antibiotics several years ago as part of a public health emergency program.
There are antibiotics in the pipeline, but the numbers are insufficient. They're insufficient to deal with the increasing rates of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and they're insufficient to deal with the normal attrition of molecules in pharmaceutical development.
Although Larson said two new antibiotics should be available in the next year or two, the marketing structure has to change. Companies normally make profits through volume sales, but antibiotics have to be used sparingly. Overuse makes them ineffective. But Bell says there are other reasons these drugs are being rendered powerless.
Antibiotic resistance is not only being generated by using too many antibiotics, but also by spread of infection from lack of hygiene, from unintended contact with soiled surfaces, things of that sort. So the infection control side is equally important.
Patients can also help. The CDC urges people to take antibiotics as prescribed and finish the prescription. Still, urgent action on a global level is needed to prevent the catastrophe that a post-antibiotic era would cause. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Next on Let's Talk, domestic violence. The problem that faces societies worldwide. Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing domestic violence. Let's Talk comes to you Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace, celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Zambia's former African Football of the Year, Kalusha Bwalya, has withdrawn. This comes less than 2 weeks before the elections for African representatives. Bwalya was voted Africa's top footballer in 1988 and then became president of Zambia's FA before he was unseated in last year's elections. He said he was pulling out to concentrate on winning a re-election to the African Governing Body's Executive Committee. Elections for African places on the new look FIFA Council will be held at the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Congress in Addis Ababa on March 16th. Bwalya was one of three candidates for the place on the FIFA Council, reserved for a representative from Africa's Anglophone countries. His withdrawal leaves a straight fight between Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantachi and Leodega Tenga of Tanzania. Africa has seven places on the FIFA Council, which has been renamed and expanded since Gianni Infantino came to power last year. Meanwhile, the president of the Djibouti Football Association, Suleiman Hassan Waberi, says he intends to vote for Ahmed Ahmed in the CAF presidential election. Waberi's stance goes against the Council for East and Central African Football Associations, CECAFA, whose members agreed to give current president Issa Hayatou their support. The CAF presidential elections will take place on March 16th in Ethiopia. The CECAFA region has 11 members: Djibouti, Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda, Burundi, Tanzania, Rwanda, Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Kenya. Ahmed, the Madagascar FA president, already has support from the Council of Southern African Football Associations, COSAFA, and from the Nigeria FA president, Amaju Pinnick, although other Nigerian FA members have criticized Pinnick's revelation. Issa Hayatou, who has presided over African football since 1988, is seeking an eighth term. Still in football, DR Congo side TP Mazembe are set to sign international defender Anthony Van Den Boer. The 29-year-old, who was born in DR Congo and has a Congolese mother, is expected to complete a free transfer to the Lubumbashi club this week. Van Den Boer had announced his retirement from football on January 10th. He played once for Belgium at the 2014 World Cup in Brazil against South Korea. Also, Ghana has installed Maxwell Konadu as caretaker coach until a permanent successor to Avram Grant is appointed. The 44-year Konadu held the position in 2014 after Kwesi Appiah left, and he has also been Ghana's assistant coach, under-20 coach, and under-23 coach. The Ghana FA announced its decision on Tuesday. Israel Grant ended his time as Ghana coach after the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations, which coincided with the expiry of his contract. He led the Black Stars to fourth place at the tournament in Gabon. In tennis, Britain's Andy Murray has beaten Spaniard Fernando Verdasco in straight sets to win the Dubai Championships for the first time. The world number one dropped his first two service games but recovered to win 6-3, 6-2 in 1 hour and 14 minutes. It's Murray's first tournament win of 2017 and the 45th of his career, which will see him extend his lead over Novak Djokovic at the top of the rankings. Murray beat Verdasco for the 13th time in 14 meetings since 2007. Now Murray heads to Los Angeles for the Indian Wells Masters that kick off next week. Murray will play his first match in California Desert next weekend. Last year, he lost in the third round at both Indian Wells and 2 weeks later at the Miami Masters. Also in tennis, American Sam Querrey claimed the biggest title of his career after defeating Rafael Nadal in a straight set in the final of the Mexican Open. The 29-year-old from California, who is world number 40, won 6-3, 7-6, 7-3 against the second seed, who was chasing his 70th career title. The Spaniard had reached the final without dropping a set, but he had no answer to Querrey's power. Finally, four-time Olympic champion Mo Farah says he's happy to be drug tested. In his words, anytime, anywhere, and for any of his historical samples to be reanalyzed. The Briton has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and says he has nothing to hide after a leaked U.S. anti-doping agency USADA report suggested that his coach had almost certainly broken anti-doping rules. USADA last weekend confirmed it had compiled a dossier on controversial coach Albert Salazar following a report accusing the athletics guru of dangerously using drugs to boost the performance of his athletes. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks for listening. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
us. Brown hair, couple done, love done.
Now you be turn. If I not eat, you no go eat, yeah. If I not sleep, you no go sleep, yeah. Couple done, one for left. Money done, one for left. If I not get, you go to be a me. Where we don't cook, we go cook a la vidi, yeah. One for left, done, one for left. Money done, one for left. I say. This time I'm story about a girl I love her most. She love me most, but things can change. Love me done this and money done it. Sweet like a sugar, money dead, we no go tire. Up and down, we go repass. Then we back and then we go realize. Asa, could you imagine? I'd give you my 10,000 every day. Then they pay me 210,000 for the money. That's couple done, love done. Now you meet her. If I don't eat, you no go eat, yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo, the opposition coalition known as Rassemblement elected Félix Tshisekedi, 53, the son of the veteran popular opposition leader Étienne Tshisekedi, to lead the coalition. This was a vital decision since the death of Etienne Tshisekedi at the beginning of the year. Fears have been expressed that the transitional agreement brokered by the Catholic Church Council may falter. In fact, views have been expressed that the government of Joseph Kabila is already trying to wiggle out of the agreement when the Minister of Finance started saying that for financial reasons, there might not be sufficient funds to hold the election in 2017 as agreed. It may be recalled that President Kabila had failed to vacate his office last year, and as a result, violence has ensued, and only the Catholic Conference was able to bring all the parties together to find a transitional agreement. That agreement called for elections to be held in 2017 and that President Kabila should not run. Now, there are not all of those in the Rassemblement that are happy with the selection of Félix Tshisekedi. They believe that he had only joined the opposition recently and lacked the 50-year experience of his father, who died at 84. But it must be recalled that history is replete with examples where to maintain a party's coalition or government, someone might be selected who has links with the incumbent. For example, the great Prime Minister William Pitt of Great Britain in the 18th century, when he died, his son, who was only 24 years old, was elected the leader of the Whig Party, and he became the youngest Prime Minister of Great Britain. We have other similar examples where, at the death of a popular political leader, his spouse may be called upon to stand for election. What has been suggested is that people in the Rassemblement should be careful not to have any division, because a division in the opposition coalition may be very grave for the politics of the DRC. It is therefore necessary to see Félix Tshisekedi as a glue that holds the coalition together. The key question now is, who will be appointed the Prime Minister of the DRC under the agreement? It has been expected that Etienne Tshisekedi would be the Prime Minister under the agreement. Will they be willing to accept his son as the new Prime Minister of the DRC? This would be the challenge of the coalition. Incidentally, it is important to note that as of yet, the party of his father, UDPS, has not yet announced his name as the new leader. The focus is, properly so, to keep the opposition coalition together. And unless they do that, it will be very, very sad for the political development of the DRC. And also, caution should be made that the government of Kabila does not try to exploit whatever disagreement there might be within the coalition because of the election of Félix Tshisekedi as the successor to his father. What is essential for the peace and stability of the DRC that they fully implement the transitional agreement which has stopped the bloodletting following the failure of Joseph Kabila to vacate office last year. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC.
From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Xiaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when an elephant falls, meat is sure to be surplus for those who follow the hunter. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for a change in the UN structure to help prevent terrorist acts directed or inspired by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other organizations. As a first step, he proposes establishing a new office headed by an undersecretary general that would coordinate and strengthen UN counterterrorism efforts of the UN General Assembly, which are dispersed among dozens of UN entities. The United States supports the UN Secretary General's reform plan and the appointment of an undersecretary general to oversee UN counterterrorism efforts. Speaking at an informal consultation of the UN General Assembly, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, noted that the new Undersecretary General will need to set clear priorities to implement the UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy. But she said there is room for the UN to do still more.
It can expand the assistance it provides to member states. It can help states stop the flow of foreign terrorist fighters. It can work with states to build more robust systems to check who is coming across a border.
Ambassador Haley said the UN can also contribute to stopping terrorist recruitment by amplifying anti-violent extremist voices in its programs and by partnering with civil society organizations that speak out against violent extremism. She highlighted the UN's work in promoting respect for human rights, including freedom of expression and the rule of law, as an essential component in preventing radicalization to violence. Ambassador Haley said, however, that defeating the most dangerous terrorist organizations cannot fully succeed until UN member states stop their own support of terrorist activity.
Proposals on paper will have limited impact as long as there are states that choose to arm, shelter, and finance terrorist organizations.
Ambassador Haley commended Secretary General Guterres's reform proposals and for the seriousness with which he considers the issue, adding, "We have much work to do to rid the world of the threat of terrorism."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.